The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, Michael Blakely here with Religion in the News. For the next 28-odd minutes, I'll be reading articles from various news services on the subject of religion. From The Economist first of March 30th, what is Good Friday? Arguments still rage about what the most solemn day in the Christian calendar stands for. For hundreds of millions of Christians around the world, Good Friday is the most solemn day in the church calendar. It is the time when they recall and often reenact the crucifixion of Jesus. In Rome, there is a torch-lit procession led by the Pope in which 14 stages in the agonizing drama are remembered. Orthodox Christians, whose Easter celebrations move about in a different system, will mark the event in a week's time with a spectacular ceremony. But apart from the obvious point that it leads onto the resurrection of Christ 2 days later, many Christians would struggle to put into words the exact meaning of Good Friday's drama. That's partly because, over the centuries, the faith's most influential thinkers have disagreed on the matter. They generally concur in regarding the execution of their faith's founder not merely as unjust and cruel punishment, but as a kind of cosmic event which transformed the relationship between God and man, freeing humanity from the power of mortality. But how exactly does that liberation from death work? To that question, Christian theologians have offered several different answers. Broadly, there are three schools of thought. One stresses that by undergoing death, Christ freed mankind through a decisive victory over the powers of darkness to which humanity was previously in thrall. One elaboration of this theory holds that the devil was tricked by Christ's death. The devil thought he was gaining a prize, but in the end it was his own power that was vanquished. The second school, prominent in Western Christianity over the last millennium, presents Christ's death as a kind of satisfaction offered to a God who has been offended by human sin. Anselm, a Catholic archbishop who died in 1109, argued that God's honor had been injured and needed reparation. Protestant reformers gave this idea a new twist by massively emphasizing the concepts of punishment and debt. As they saw it, human wickedness had created an obligation which a just God was bound to call in, and which humanity alone could not discharge. Under this theory of penal substitution, man could never have paid this vast moral debt, but God's Son did so instead, thus freeing man from its consequence, to which was death. A third and simpler way of thinking speaks of the moral influence which Jesus exercised through his loving life and self-sacrificing death. Disputes about all this still rage among today's Christians. Evangelical Protestants, who are an influential force in the United States, put huge emphasis on the idea of penal substitution, the idea that God the Father had to impose a punishment for human sin, and that Jesus saved mankind by stepping in to endure that retribution. Some evangelicals see that doctrine as so basic to their faith that they cannot accept as Christian anyone who rejects it. Orthodox Christians, by contrast, have never been comfortable with penal substitution. Their liturgy uses images of victory, ransom, and cheating the devil. Some of today's liberal Protestants are unhappy with penal substitution, and they prefer to use a mixture of victory language and moral influence. Whatever happened on that hill in Jerusalem 2,000 years ago, it was enough to keep people arguing for a long time. And from the Religion News Service now of March 30th, Politics, Persecution, and Ardent Love, a new movie aims to show why Paul is still relevant. It's been 14 years since Jim Caviezel played the role of Jesus in The Passion of the Christ. The actor, who previously starred in the 1998 war movie The Thin Red Line, said he didn't know then how Mel Gibson's 2004 film would break him, how it would haunt him. He told Religion News Service that he didn't know, quote, it was going to be my path. But now that path has led him back to a story straight from the scriptures, playing Luke, one of Christianity's four evangelists, in the new film Paul, Apostle of Christ. So did the film's message of forgiveness and what Caviezel calls ardent love? It's a very arduous task to treat someone with polar opposite views with the same dignity and respect that you would treat a friend, and that is the core message of the film, and it's what makes this film, he said. Even though it was a couple thousand years ago, it's very relevant today. Paul, Apostle of Christ, opened in the top 10 at the box office last weekend, according to Box Office Mojo. It's one of several movies aimed at Christian audiences releasing around Sunday's Easter holiday on April 1. I can only imagine. The story behind the popular Christian song of the same name finished third for the second straight week at the box office, and Mary Magdalene, about one of Jesus' more prominent female followers, releases this weekend, March 30th. The movie about Paul comes as the apostle is having something of a moment, with a number of new books published about him in the past few years. They include Paul, a Biography by N.T. Wright, and Paul, an Apostle's Journey by Douglas A. Campbell, both released earlier this year, and Reading Paul with the Reformers, Reconciling Old and New Perspectives by Stephen J. Chester, and Paul and Gender, Reclaiming the Apostle's Vision from Men and Women in Christ by Cynthia Long Westfall, both recognized in Christianity Today's 2018 Book Awards. I don't know if it's providence that's directing us to refocus on the teachings of Paul, but it's quite a wonderful experience to see it all come together, said Richard Peluso, Senior Vice President of Affirm Films, part of Sony Pictures. Paul resonates not only because he dominates so much of the New Testament, but because he's a familiar figure in our current media landscape. The type to say boo to every goose and then say boo to all the swans as well, just in case, according to author and biblical scholar Wright, who said before the film's release he hadn't seen it but was intrigued. That makes Paul unlike many of history's great thinkers. It also presented some difficulty bringing his story to the screen, Peluso said. It spans 60 years and 10,000 miles, a blinding encounter with Jesus, a shipwreck, imprisonments, miracles, feuds, and more. That's why filmmakers decided to focus on Paul's last days in prison before his execution, though a TV miniseries is a possibility, depending on the success of Paul, the Apostle of Christ, the film, Peluso said. In the film, Luke, played by Caviezel, meets with Paul, played by James Faulkner, in prison to record his dramatic conversion and other reflections into what would become the Book of Acts. Meantime, the early church struggles against persecution by the Roman government and how to respond to it. Christ called us to care for the world, not rule it, says one character, protesting when others discuss breaking into the prison to free Paul and overthrow the government. At this moment in our culture and in our world, I think we really are starting to doubt this idea of grace and mercy and forgiveness and love, and Paul's story is such a strong example of just the enormity of God's grace and love, I think it's something so needed right now, said writer-director Andrew Hyatt. Hyatt said he hoped the film would help viewers see biblical figures like Paul as real people and not beautiful statues with halos on their heads, and books like Acts and Paul's letters as a lived experience, not something that came from a preachy, heady space. He added that he hopes the movie appeals to both Christian and non-Christian audiences, that it's not too preachy, while still also respecting the concern some Christians have about scripture in the hands of Hollywood filmmakers. I think there's a big hesitancy when it comes to Hollywood Bible movies, and I think there's a kind of nervousness and a fear, oh no, did they screw it up again, said Hyatt. I just want to encourage the audience that this is a film by people for whom the story is as important to them as it is to the audience. We want people to get excited and to be encouraged. And from the Associated Press now of March 28th, the man accused in the slayings of six men in a Quebec City mosque asked for forgiveness after changing his mind and pleading guilty. Alexander Bissonnette faced six charges of first-degree murder and six of attempted murder from a shooting rampage during evening prayers at the Islamic Cultural Center in January 17. More than 50 people were at the center, and six men aged between 39 and 60 were killed. Quote, every minute of my existence, I bitterly regret what I did, the lives I have destroyed, the pain and suffering I have caused to so many people, without forgetting the members of my own family, Alexander Bissonnette said as he read out a letter in court on Wednesday. I am ashamed of what I did. The 28-year-old spoke to the court shortly after a judge accepted his guilty pleas. Many people in the courtroom burst out sobbing and held hands as the judge confirmed the guilty pleas. Bissonnette originally pleaded not guilty to the 12 charges during a court appearance Monday morning, but a few hours later announced that he wanted to plead guilty. Superior Court Justice Francois Huot refused to accept the pleas Monday afternoon, pending a psychiatric assessment of the accused to ensure he fully understood the consequences of his decision. Huot placed a publication ban on the Monday afternoon proceedings. He accepted the 12 guilty pleas on Wednesday. The fact that Bissonnette was never charged with any terrorism-related counts angered many people, particularly those in the Muslim community. On Wednesday, the accused addressed the terrorism angle. "Despite what has been said about me, I am neither a terrorist nor an Islamophobe. Rather, I am someone who was overcome by fear, by negative thoughts, and a sort of horrible kind of despair." On Monday, Bissonnette said he wanted to plead guilty in order to, quote, avoid a trial and for the victims not to have to relive this tragedy. Bissonnette told the judge that he had then been thinking about it for some time of pleading guilty, but he was missing certain pieces of evidence which were relayed Sunday. When Huot asked him if he was fully aware of what he was doing, Bissonnette replied, "Yes." Huot asked Bissonnette whether he knew he would be getting a life sentence, and he answered, "I understand." Huot also asked if he understood that he could receive consecutive sentences, meaning 150 years of prison. "I know," Bissonnette replied in a low voice. Psychiatrist Sylvain Fauché said Bissonnette is, quote, fit to stand trial and to plead what he wants to plead. "He did not want to be the perpetrator of another collective drama," said Fauché, who met with Bissonnette on Monday evening. Many members of Quebec City's Muslim community were present in court Monday and Wednesday. Amir Bekosemi, whose 60-year-old father Khaled Bekosemi was among those killed, said no one wanted to live the trauma again. "That the trial won't have to take place is a good thing for us. It's a good thing for everyone in the community," he said, very relieved. Jury selection had been scheduled to start April 3rd, and the trial to last for 2 months. Sentencing arguments will take place at a later date. Those who monitor extremist groups in Quebec described Bissonnette, a French-Canadian university student, as someone who took extreme nationalist positions at Laval University and on social media, and he was a supporter of French far-right leader Marine Le Pen and U.S. President Donald Trump. And now, from the Guardian of March 31, Beijing and the Vatican are reportedly close to an agreement on the appointment of bishops in China, a deal that could lead to the resumption of diplomatic ties severed almost 70 years ago. The Secretary General of the Bishops' Conference of the Catholic Church in China, Guo Jinsai, told Chinese state media on Thursday negotiations between the two sides had reached the, quote, final stages, and an accord could be reached as early as the end of this month. The Catholic Church and China's atheist Communist Party have long been at odds over Beijing's refusal to recognize the Pope as head of the church in the country. Now, an agreement that recognizes the Vatican's authority but approves Beijing's say in the appointments of bishops may be in the offing. China, which cut off ties with the Vatican in 1951, appoints bishops through its Chinese Patriotic Catholic Association, which runs state-sanctioned churches. An estimated half of China's 10 million to 12 million Catholics worship in underground churches, headed by bishops that have remained loyal to the Pope. Under the deal, the Vatican could ask these underground bishops to serve under the bishops appointed by Beijing in exchange for influence over future appointments. The Pope has reportedly agreed to accept 7 bishops appointed by Beijing that the Church had previously deemed illegitimate. Asked in a press briefing about Guo's remarks, a spokesman for China's Ministry of Foreign Affairs said the two sides were, quote, making positive efforts. And China hoped the dialogue would continue so that positive results can be achieved. And yet the Vatican has contradicted Guo's statements. Vatican spokesman Greg Burke told journalists on Thursday, quote, "I can state that there is no imminent signature of an agreement between the Holy See and the People's Republic of China." He added that Pope Francis was, quote, in constant contact with his advisors on the issue and has been accompanying the steps in the ongoing dialogue. Critics of a deal between Beijing and the Vatican say it would constitute a moral blow to the Catholic Church. China has tightened restrictions on religious groups and cracked down on underground churches. This week, an underground bishop in China's southwestern Fujian province, Guo Jingxin, was detained for refusing to celebrate Mass with a government-backed bishop. And there are other obstacles. It's unclear what would happen to China's hundreds of underground Catholic churches or the Vatican's diplomatic recognition of Taiwan, which Beijing says is a violation of its One China policy. Some also fear a deal would further fragment the Catholic community in China. On Chinese religious news site Jian Guozhou, one commenter wrote, "The Pope has betrayed his beliefs. We won't listen to him. We will keep our way as an underground church. We will believe what we believe and do what we should do." And back to The Economist now of March 30th. The Pope and hell. Why a papal comment about hell triggered a misunderstanding, and what Francis believes about eternal punishment. On Tuesday, two distinguished elderly gentlemen who live in Rome, one aged 81, the other 93, had a warm meeting at the younger one's residence. It was the latest in a series of pleasant and stimulating conversations they have enjoyed in recent years. A few days later, they seem to be having a public misunderstanding about hell, or rather, about what exactly one of them said on that subject. The people were Pope Francis and Eugenio Scalfari, the founder of the left-wing newspaper La Repubblica, who is an avowed non-believer. In keeping with Mr. Scalfari's well-established style, he avoided using notebooks or tape recorders during his papal chat. However, on March 29th, he published his own impressions of the meeting, together with some lengthy direct quotes that reflected his memory of what the pontiff had said. The most controversial bit was an answer the generalist apparently received to his question on the fate of unrepentant sinners. Francis is quoted as saying something like, "They are not punished. Those who repent obtain God's forgiveness and take their place among the ranks of those who contemplate him, but those who do not repent and cannot be forgiven disappear. A hell does not exist. The disappearance of sinning souls exists." This caused embarrassment in the Vatican because it appeared to contradict the Catechism of the Catholic Church, its formal doctrinal statement. That document says, "The teaching of the Church affirms the existence of hell and its eternity. Immediately after death, the souls of those who die in a state of mortal sin descend into hell, where they suffer the punishments of hell, eternal fire." As has happened after previous meetings between Mr. Scalfari and the Pope, but with even more emphasis, the Vatican Press Office issued a statement saying their encounter was a private conversation, not an interview. The, quote, "reconstruction" by Mr. Scalfari should not be considered a faithful transcription of the Holy Father's words. That will have relieved some people. In other contexts, Pope Francis has spoken of hell as a real fate that awaits those who exclude themselves from God, and he certainly has a robust belief in the need to do battle with the devil, who cunningly fills people's heads with all manner of deceptive ideas about themselves and the world. The Vatican's clarification was described in some press reports as a rebuke to Mr. Scalfari, but was it? At a stretch, the Pope's reported words might be compatible with, or at least not too far distant from, the Church's standard teaching, as laid out by some of its most firmly traditionalist representatives, including his predecessor, John Paul II. The Polish pontiff said hell was, quote, "the ultimate consequence of sin itself, rather than a place. Hell indicates the state of those who freely and definitively separate themselves from God, the source of all life and joy." Like most recent church pronouncements, that one makes clear that hell is not a physical location, but rather a condition. At least in that sense, hell is said not to exist. John Paul implies that it is an absence, that life can only be fully experienced in communion with God, so that conscious rejection of that communion automatically implies an end to existence in the fullest sense. This is represented as a tragic choice rather than divine retribution. In any case, none of these arguments will distract Pope Francis from leading the elaborate and beautiful services that mark Easter weekend. In Christian teaching, Easter Saturday is often associated with the harrowing of hell, in other words, the moment when, having faced death himself, Christ descends to the world of the dead and frees the people who have departed before him. And back to the Religion News Service now of March 29th. As conservative Judaism struggles with declining numbers and resources, two of its key leaders are stepping down. Rabbi Julie Schoenfield and Rabbi Steve Wernick announced their intentions in separate statements released in the last week. Schoenfield, the CEO of Rabbinical Assembly, the International Association of Conservative Rabbis, said she would not renew her contract in 2019. Quote, "Serving the Rabbinical Assembly as its executive has been a great privilege and pleasure, and yet I find myself at a moment in my career where there are new challenges I want to pursue, and this is the time to do so," she wrote. Schoenfield, age 52, the first woman to serve in that role, did not elaborate on what she planned to do next. She's taking a sabbatical beginning January 1. At the same time, Wernick, CEO of the United Synagogue of Conservative Judaism, the network that supports the movement's synagogues, also announced that he would not be seeking a new term in 2019. The departures at the top of the conservative movement, the nation's second largest Jewish branch, come at a time of rapid change. In addition to being hit by declining numbers and resources, the movement is divided over its approach to intermarriage. Many rabbis would like the prohibition on presiding at interfaith marriages to be lifted. Others disagree. The issue has been referred to the Committee on Law and Standards. The conservative movement represents about 18% of American Jews, according to the Pew Research Center, and occupies a middle place in American Judaism. At one end is the Reform movement, the largest, with about 35% of American Jews. On the other are various Orthodox Jewish groups, which cleave most closely to traditional Jewish law and claim about 10% of American Jews. And about 30% of Jews are described by Pew Research as, quote, no denomination, and 6% as others. Demographer Stephen N. Cohen estimated that there were about 570,000 congressionally affiliated conservative Jews in 2013, down from 723,000 in 1990. Schoenfield may best be remembered for helping shepherd a new prayer book, Lev Shalem. Rabbi Deborah Newman Kamen, the incoming president of the Rabbinical Assembly, said a new leader would not be appointed soon. "We don't want to rush anything," she said. "We want to do a thoughtful investigation of what the Rabbinical Assembly needs." Wernick, who came on as CEO in 2009, said he missed being a pulpit rabbi. "My heart was always in the pulpit," he said. "I want to find something that has me more directly engaging with the Jewish people and less doing administration." 5 years ago, Wernick laid off 10% of the USCJ staff to balance its budget. The shortfalls were caused by a decline in dues and weak fundraising, and the movement has about 575 synagogues across North America in its network. And to The Economist one more time of March 26th. Christianity in Europe. As French Catholics hail a martyr, the faith is fading in Europe. The sense of default Christianity is vanishing. Even in Europe, which is the world's least religious continent, a dramatic turn of events can turn a little-known public servant into a posthumous hero hailed as a kind of modern martyr. Arnaud Beltram, a police colonel, died of his injuries over the weekend after voluntarily taking the place of one of the hostages seized by a fanatical Islamist in a small French town. As it happens, he was a devout Catholic who devoted much spare time to pilgrimages and to helping with religious instruction. He won praise from two different kinds. Speaking for the French Republic, President Emmanuel Macron described him as a man who had, quote, fallen as a hero and deserved the respect and admiration of the entire nation. In the Catholic circles to which Beltram belonged, another vocabulary was used. He was praised as a man whose self-sacrifice reflected the faith that he had eagerly professed since a conversion experience a decade ago. Comparisons were made with Maximilian Kolbe, a Polish friar who in 1941 stood in for a fellow prisoner, a man with children, whom the Nazis were preparing to execute. A French priest who had been preparing to solemnize the policeman's marriage, he was already married civilly, instead found himself sitting at his friend's bedside conducting the last rites. With understandable emotion, the cleric described Beltram as a man who, quote, had a passion for France, her greatness, her history, and her Christian roots when he rediscovered with his conversion. But whatever that the truth in that statement about cultural roots, how much longer will such language be comprehensible, let alone appealing, to people growing up on the continent? A study of religious attitudes and practice among Europe's young adults, published a few days ago, found that faith was shrinking almost to a vanishing point in several countries, although there was huge variation across the continent. Europe's secularization, reflecting a breakup of traditional communities and more materialistic attitudes, is familiar to sociologists, but its impact is highlighted in recent numbers. Among people aged 16 to 29, the Czech Republic showed the lowest level of piety, with 91% of that age group saying they had no religion. Similarly high levels of indifference to religion were found in Estonia, 80%, Sweden, 75%, and the Netherlands, 72%. Majorities of young adults in Britain and France were equally untouched by organized faith. Even in Russia, whose leaders contrast their nation's healthy traditionalism with the decadent West, almost half, 49%, of young adults acknowledge no religion. But some countries remain quite devout, in particular Poland, where only 17% of young adults call themselves non-religious, and 82% identified as Catholic. In France, the study found, some 23% of that generation call themselves Catholic, compared with 10% who professed Islam and 2% who were Protestants. In Britain, only 7% of young adults identified with Anglicanism, the established faith of England, less than 10% who described themselves as Catholic. Followers of England's state religion may soon be outnumbered by Muslims, who now amount to 6% of the young cohort. Stephen Bullivant, a professor of theology and sociology at St. Mary's University in London, produced the figures by crunching data in the European Social Survey of 2014 to 2016, an academic project which spans the continent and also includes Israel. He concluded that the sense of being Christian by default was vanishing across much of Europe, although loyalty to Catholicism remains quite robust in certain countries. In some places, like Poland and Portugal, Catholic allegiance was accompanied by comparatively high church attendance, whereas in others, Lithuania, Austria, have a cultural loyalty to Catholicism, but only a minority seriously practiced. Generally, loyalty to Catholicism is holding up better than loyalty to what he called state-affiliated Protestant bodies, such as the National Churches of Scandinavia, and Europe has no equivalent to America's zealous evangelicals. Catholic figures for England and France are boosted by immigration from more devout places, such as Poland, the Philippines, West Africa, and Christian pockets of India. In any case, they do not portend any huge religious revival. Among young adults in France who called themselves Catholic, only 7% said they attended Mass weekly. So, perhaps the only feature of Arnaud Beltrán's life, which was typical rather than extraordinary, is this, that for the first 33 of his 45 years, he was barely conscious of the Catholic faith of his forebears. Well, that's all the time we have now for Religion in the News. This has been Michael Blakely. I'll talk to you later.